some people who I've known for very many years. And many of you have sharpened my thoughts, which has led me to this lecture tonight. And in a sense, I guess it is autobiographical. But my theme this evening is the relationship between the individual and the community. I want to give two examples. One of an individual who feels weighed down, who feels reduced to a statistic. And the other example is of an individual who has found what true community should mean. The first example, a protest against depersonalisation, concerns my son. He wrote a note to the Australian Taxation Office, signing himself by his tax file number. "Dear tax computer," he wrote, "I am tax file number XXB2397, otherwise known as Daniel Charles Stevenson, etc. In contrast to my son's protest, a friend in our meeting, Barbara Whitney, said in meeting for worship, "I am so happy to be coming to meeting this morning to be amongst friends whom I love and revere. The meeting is my family." As we all know, Australian society is in danger of reducing individuals to a statistic. Even a school child is known as a client, according to the Education Department. In Ryrie Street, Geelong, the other day, I noticed an office sign. It said, "Human Services," and it sounded a little as though it was an equivalent of the Animal Welfare League. In a bureaucratic environment, communities, such as the Religious Society of Friends, are all the more urgently needed, for a basic human need is for a community where each individual is a living part of the group. I believe that my subject is of crucial importance to this age. The recent month-long Vatican meeting of Roman Catholic bishops raised as a main concern what they call the privatisation of religion, seen as a matter of purely personal and private concern, like a hobby. They see an overemphasis of the individual to the detriment of the community and social structure. I too want to talk about individuality, but not to any detriment. I believe individuality is enriched, informed, stimulated by the society in which we live. So I want to talk about those things that bind us together in the things that are eternal, those things that make us so happy to come to meeting. I shall say something about the bewilderment of the present age and what I would call the yearning to belong, the need to look at ourselves both inwardly and outwardly, and about our individual responsibility. I want to talk about how the Quaker rediscovery of silence gives a deeper meaning to our interaction. I need to talk too about when the axe wielder comes to the beautiful tree of our society, of our Quaker community, and destroys its symmetry when things fall apart. Fundamentally, we are social beings, gregarious much more than we are aware. Our belonging to social groups is an inescapable and fulfilling part of life. We must come to terms with this need for community and learn how to cope in group interrelationships. before we can vitalize our own personal nature. I am the vine, ye are the branches. What I am saying about the interwining of the group community and the individual was aptly written by John Donne. And let's not stumble over the sexist language of 1624. No man is an island entire of itself. Any man's best diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. One of the key points I wish to make this evening comes from Jean-Paul Sartre in his play, We Cloth. L'enfer, c'est les autres, he says. Hell is other people. In the sense that others inflict agony and soul-searching on the individual, others are a mirror of ourself. The other person reveals to me an aspect of myself of which I can have no knowledge without the other person's judgment. We can only truly know ourselves by perceiving what others think of us. Sartre highlights the fact that society has a powerful and covert influence in shaping the individual. Hell is other people, says Sartre. And I would like to put it a little bit more positively. We are embraced by other selves. As individuals, we are easily bewildered and lost in our late 20th century society. We are trapped. Society bestows many benefits, yet it can crush our humanity. The individual is respected, and laws have been enacted to assure that this is so, but nevertheless, we are dehumanised by economic rationalism, by the trauma of ostracism. We are burdened by fragmented loyalties and by straining after perfection in a world of muddle. We face continual change. We become different beings in the mass group, and we all belong to subcultures, each with its flaws as well as its strengths. For a time, the postmodern social trend reinforced individualization, tolerance, and liberal attitudes replaced old prohibitions. The state has been increasingly aware of the rights of the individual, especially in social security areas. Certainly, our lifestyles have increasingly come to terms with a wide diversity of behaviour and tolerance of a variety of values. Society is much more sensitive to feminist issues, to the rights of lesbians and gays, and the rights of children. Yet, in this apparently enlightened environment, how is it that violent, anti-racial attitudes have surfaced so menacingly? If we do a somersault and review our Australian society from a different perspective, we see different things. We live in an era of the new simplistic god of economic rationalism. Do we live in a society or in an economy? While we enjoy civil liberties, there is chilling dehumanisation by cost effectiveness, strategic plans, performance indicators, and profits. How much is unemployment the outcome of greed for profits and dividends? Listen to the 1996 Swarthmore lecturer. In conditions of gross material inequality, equality of opportunity is a sham. Real opportunities remain starkly unequal. Ostracism remains one of the most potent assaults on an individual. Nothing so numbs the mind and deadens natural fervour for life. With the disappearance of trust or love, what was once hallowed and satisfying can become sterile and sour. To be rejected and regarded as a second-rate citizen reduces one's self-esteem and self-confidence, and it can create traumas that trick our judgment. Equally as serious as ostracism is industrial, urbanised society contempt for the environment and our consequent alienation. One of the most intractable difficulties of life is change. The accustomed things are not going to be there forever. Relationships, routine, the status quo will not always be the same, nor viewed from the same perspective. In my daughter's room, there hangs a crystal, and it's angled to catch the light, and depending on the moment, it may flash blue or green or yellow. But it also depends on the angle of the observer. A different stand, a different coloured light. To me, this crystal encapsulates the whole paradox of change. I like the attitude expressed by Peter Robinson. Embrace this moment and move on. We can only live in this moment. It is in this moment that God is with us, whether it is a moment of joy or a moment of agony, a moment of light or darkness, whether at rest, work or play, alone or in company. And like our Australian kangaroo, which cannot jump backwards, the world can only have meaning if it goes forward. And we continually discard our sworn conceptions. And we know what George Fox meant when he said, "This I knew experimentally." My son started me a year or two ago when he told us that our 25 years of marriage represented roughly 1/8 of the whole history of European settlement in Australia. And put into a fraction, this 25 years is seen in stark reality, how much extraordinary a change occurs in so short a time. And some change is almost more than one can bear. And there are those who cannot adapt to change and can cause untold difficulties for a community group. Instead of meeting the challenge, they are frightened and bewildered. An institutionalised society creates a clash of fragmented loyalties, compromise with the world, yet rejecting so many of the world's values, aggression, greed, economic inequality, and so on. The confusion caused by society's conflicts is especially distressing if we strain after perfection. Our tidy minds like and expect organised routine. Yet society isn't so tidily organised. Muddling through is now a theory of social change. It explains Quaker business meetings. And such a theory explains some national issues where competing ideologies kindle new directions. History contains muddle. Yet, in the overview of centuries, society works itself out of the morass of confusion towards something better. Muddling through also explains the individual experience. In his novel, Morris, where the main theme is the muddle of the individual mind, E.M. Forster says this, He seemed a bundle of voices, and now he could hear them quarrelling inside him. I think this is perhaps the universal experience. There are always undercurrents working just under the surface of our mind. It is not always the one clear message that stimulates our vision. Something, our spiritual nature perhaps, lies dormant within, waiting to be set off. And when it does, it can charge our lives with new passion or new outlook, like George Fox. When I heard it, my heart did leap for joy. And so suddenly, we find through life's vicissitudes that we do arrive. Innately, we have known that there is something else, soulless in spiritual things. We are bewildered no more. We have found that missing quality. We find deliverance from the bondage of society's confusions, and we seek strength from the unseen world of the spirit. Some of us read religious writings. We find ourselves at church, or for some very few of us, at a Quaker meeting. There was something better in life than this rubbish, if only he could get it. Love, nobility, big spaces where passion clasped peace, spaces no science could reach. E. M. Forster finds what his soul has been searching for, and so for us. It is in the silence that we sense deliverance from a world that has encroached on the private domain of our deeper needs, our hopes, and our spiritual intuitions. I want to say something about the yearning to belong, a fundamental human instinct that overrides all the bewilderments of society. However much we safeguard our individuality, we do remain tribal. We belong to subcultures, our churches, professional organisations, leisure groups. They are necessary to our well-being, and we cannot exist without the many advantages that the group provides. The branch cannot bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine. An example from literature illustrates this point. John Steinbeck, in his novel In Dubious Battle, has a hero, Jim. And Jim says, "My old man used to fight alone. When he got licked, he was licked. But I'm not lonely anymore, and I can't be licked because I am more than myself." This is plainly put. Expresses the experience of the strength that fires the individual who has something to believe in, some cause to work for, and to which to give his or her energies. Steinbeck's Jim had been a loner, but now, having joined the Communist Party, he was helping to organise a strike, and as a consequence had something to live for. "You get a hell of a drive out of something that has some meaning to it," he says. And, of course, we need something to live for. It helps to give meaning to life. Caution is needed. Arthur Koestler points out a startling paradox. He says this, that our human tragedy is not an excess of aggression, but an excess of devotion. The soldier is not so much out to annihilate the enemy, but has rallied to the flag to defend a cause. Loyalty, self-sacrifice to all sorts of causes, from Christianity to communism, can only make sense if one considers the loyalty and self-sacrifice as though one belonged to the clan. And Koestler describes this as being another being, in which individuality is submerged and the individual takes on a new identity. his example, the conscript, who as an individual is forbidden to kill, as a disciplined member of his unit, is in duty bound to do so. The group is not the synthesis of all the individuals, but what John Steinbeck has called the group human. And his character Jim says about a mob of strikers off to break a barricade across the road, and it's stronger than all the men put together. It doesn't want the same thing men want. It's as different from men as dogs are. And unfortunately, the media feed upon and nourish this group human, so that those within it quickly lose their identity, their sense of purpose and belief in the value of the individual. So fragile is the individual mind that it all too easily slides down the embankment into the brutish realms of the mob mentality. At the dawn of civilization, when life was precarious, unquestioning submission was necessary for survival. Even in the Middle Ages, the serf belonged to the Lord. It was only with the Enlightenment that the individual became important. And the Society of Friends was part of that development. For believing in the intrinsic worth of every individual, Friends placed the importance of the individual above the demands of the group society. And of course, freedom, not as a synonym for self-will, but responsible freedom, was at the heart of the liberalism that arose out of that period when Friends arose. One afternoon, I was walking through Stanley Chasm out from Alice Springs. Immense cliff faces arose on either side, as high as these walls here, and they were overpowering. They sort of confined the individual to a narrow space in which to roam, a narrow sandy floor about 6 metres wide. And the atmosphere created awe, and I felt it was a sharp reminder of our relative insignificance as individuals on this earth. And this chasm illustrates the restraints necessary, of necessary discipline within society. It is a discipline that strengthens freedom. And the analogy of Stanley Chasm suggests the liberation that we finally achieve through having been contained. For, on reaching the end of the chasm, one is inspired by the sunlight on the stark nature. And to me, the changing light in the chasm says something about a fundamental tension in the Society of Friends, and indeed in any movement that survives through generations. We must have change, and we need sometimes desperately the vitality of new people. On the other hand, we must not neglect the wisdom of the experienced friends. There are certain constancies to maintain if we are to preserve our unique method of worship, our way of conducting business, and our distinctive testimonies. And those cliffs of Stanley Chasm are solid and huge, but they have been gouged through millennia of abrasion by floodwaters. Now, we don't want change take millions of years, but we do want change that is steady and creative. I believe that the Society of Friends is as democratic as any organisation can be, and it is a community in which the individual can feel his or her worth. And for that reason, I want to discuss the Society of Friends as a community that is genuinely individualistic, an organisation where we can find solace from the bewilderments of life. And sometimes it is difficult for a newcomer, friends to grasp fully that there is no authoritarian figurehead in charge. And occasionally, a newcomer might try to fill this lack. There are no set rules and no imposed discipline, but there are conventions. And I believe in the Society of Friends, discipline is self-motivated from the light within. And I believe that this is the crucial issue which prevents an overbearing attitude. And I believe that this is a safety valve that can stop fanaticism and intolerance. This light within is a touchstone that the Quaker approach to life. It is the inner spirit of love and truth which we believe guides us into a right relationship not only with God, with our individual self, but also with others in our community. That friends are like-minded is the closest we can come to the usual society at large understanding of group rules. And in such an environment, there is no place for grandstanding. Those who give us hope are neither self-appointed moralisers, nor preachers, and still less those who patronise, who want to improve and reform us. It is the quiet undergirders. Those who show compassion, give non-judgmental support, those who offer the heart of friendship. This is true community. In his epistle, James described the essence of it. The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. From the experience of the meeting for worship comes a refreshed consciousness of right relationships. Once again, we are reclothed in our rightful minds. There comes a sense of our oneness with creation, a realisation of the unity of life. The meeting for worship gives us strength with which to face the anomalies, injustices and frenzies of society at large. And a Quaker meeting should reflect the Jewish shalom, which Eva Pinthus describes as wholeness, healing, justice, righteousness, equality, unity, freedom and community. It is a vision of all the people whole, well and one, and of all nature whole, well and one. In a Quaker meeting, as in any other community, it is in the variety of human relationships that we grow, both individually and together. Not only do we have the wisdom and acceptance of life by the aged, we have the young with their happy freshness and wonderment. We not only meet persons of different ages and interests, but from a variety of backgrounds. And as we rely on one another, our stature grows. The recently established Meeting for Learning and programs such as the Alternative to Violence program all deepen our community life and understanding of one another. But the supreme genius, of course, for community solidarity, as far as friends are concerned, is the annual yearly meeting. When friends come together from all over Australia, residentially to worship, to further the business of the society, and equally importantly, to mingle together informally. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. This is the key to the function of any religious community. It was announced at that crucial Christian event, the Last Supper, when Jesus is about to leave the disciples to their own sufficiency. And how significant that the Last Supper was not in a church, but in the house. It was a social meal. And does this fact not emphasize friendship, community, and caring for one another? Every act, say Quakers, should be a sacramental act. An impossible ideal, perhaps, but it does affirm that our relationships with each other must spring from the love of which Jesus spoke at the Last Supper. Why, then, is such love one of the most difficult things to translate into practice? And I'd like to spend some time considering that. I believe that this is indeed one of the great